Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 297 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, which will be a really short one, I'll be doing the rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK exam. And this will be series 52. We will be discussing a host of vignettes on the, the USMLE exam. And again, I will encourage you to kind of keep these in mind. It'd be really helpful to you as you study for your test. And again, basically all the stuff that I have on this website for Step 2 CK, it's pretty applicable to Step 3 as well, to be honest with you. Because really Step 3 is essentially a Step 2 CK rehash, but with a lot of biostats, a lot of ethics. And, they bring back some stuff from Step 1 with, immunodeficiency diseases and whatnot. And by the way, I have a podcast on how to study for Step 3, right? So first thing, what if they give you a question about a patient? They tell you that he's like a 22-year-old guy and his parents, his dad has diabetes, his mom has hypertension and she has had one stroke. And, his BMI is like 24. What if they ask you, like, what's your next best step, right? They love to make these screening questions. And many times, for whatever reason, the right thing is to go ahead and screen these people for hyperlipidemia. In fact, it's actually kind of high yield to know the hyperlipidemia guidelines, right? So remember that for hyperlipidemia, you can start screening at the age of 20, pretty much for everybody, right? Pretty much for everybody. And you can screen roughly every 5 years, right? And remember, you make decisions based on people's LDL cholesterol, right? Not based on their total cholesterol. It's the LDL cholesterol you make decisions based on, right? And again, if a person has really, really high LDL cholesterol, just go ahead and put them on a statin, okay? Go ahead and put them on a statin. Although if a person has hypertriglyceridemia, what should you be giving to those people? Well, I'd hope you're saying that, Divine, okay, let's give them a fibrate, right? Remember those fibrates like gemfibrozil, fenofibrate, clofibrate. Those drugs, right? They are the best at reducing triglycerides, right? And you may be like, Divine, how can hypertriglyceridemia present on an MBM exam? Well, it can present as a person having like epigastric pain, right? And they will tell you that they don't take alcohol, and the person, doesn't have any gallstones or whatever, stuff like that. If you see things like that, you really want to think more along the lines of hypertriglyceridemia causing their pancreatitis. For those people, they can ask, which of the following interventions will most likely reduce the incidence of these episodes, right? You want to think about giving those people a fibrate. Again, fibrates are awesome for reducing a person's triglyceride levels, right? And one nice thing that your friends at the MBME love to do with Step 2 CK, Step 3, is they like to bring some throwbacks again from Step 1. In fact, they're bringing a lot of throwbacks from Step 1, right? So what's the big thing I think I should mention here? They may ask you like, what's the mechanism by which a statin lowers a person's cholesterol? It's actually, again, they know that most people know that, statins are inhibitors of HMG-CoA reductase. Great, right? But how exactly do statins actually lower a person's cholesterol? Well, the thing that you should be looking for in your exam is the answer that says increase the expression of LDL receptors, right? Or look for the answer that says increase clearance of LDL cholesterol from the circulation, right? By hepatic receptors, right? So why is that? Because if you think about it, the liver has the ability to synthesize its own cholesterol, right? It does that through HMG-CoA reductase. Now, if for some reason you inhibit HMG-CoA reductase, then the liver is not going to be able to synthesize its own cholesterol, right? So the intracellular concentration of LDL cholesterol in the hepatocyte will go down. So the hepatocyte will be like, okay, I can't make, so I guess I might as well go ahead and finagle some cholesterol from the circulation. So you begin to express more LDL receptors. As you express more of those LDL receptors, you'll then go ahead and draw more LDL into the hepatocyte, and that will lower the person's LDL cholesterol levels, right? And then one other thing that I want to say that can be an unusual vignette on your exam is they can give you a question about a person that has like some kind of familial hypertriglyceridemia, right? And then they tell you that, this person goes for surgery, you know, is placed under anesthesia, is getting like an infusion. And then they can tell you that, oh, wow, a few minutes or hours after surgery, the patient begins to have a lot of abdominal discomfort, a lot of epigastric pain radiating to the back. If you look at that, if you see a question like that, you want to think about the person having pancreatitis, right? So you may be like, Divine, what triggered their pancreatitis? Well, think about it. If a person has a familial hypertriglyceridemia, at baseline, those people's triglycerides are pretty high, right? So one of the most common things that I use to induce anesthesia to kind of knock a person out is propofol. Well, what does propofol contain a ton of? Propofol contains a ton of lipid, right? So it's something that you absolutely want to avoid in a person that has a high triglyceride level at baseline or has a familial hypertriglyceridemia kind of deal. To be honest with you, if I'm not mistaken, this may have played out in one of my, in a patient that I saw like back in the day. Actually, I won't say where or when, right, for HIPAA purposes. So just something to keep at the back of your mind for exams, right? So again, that's a very nice way that they can integrate pharmacology, right, with that whole pathology of having familial hypertriglyceridemia. And I guess since we're talking about screening, right, if they give you a question ever about a person that smokes and they say, oh, which of the following will most likely reduce, you know, improve this person's quality of life, reduce morbidity, reduce mortality. If smoking cessation is an answer and they smoke, you should pick smoking cessation as your answer, right? I mean, smoking is the biggest risk factor for so many bad things, right? So many bad things, right? I mean, like one of the best things you can do for your patients is to get them to quit smoking, right? Because smoking increases a person's risk for many, many things, right? It's literally the biggest risk factor for myocardial infarction, right? It's the biggest risk factor for peripheral arterial disease, right? It's the biggest risk factor for renal artery stenosis. I'm telling you this may actually sound like a shocker to some of you. When a person has renal artery stenosis, the biggest risk factor is smoking, right? Because remember, people that smoke, they get a lot of essentially an accelerated atherosclerosis, right? Like they get accelerated atherosclerosis, they get MIs, accelerated atherosclerosis, they get PAD, accelerated atherosclerosis, they get renal artery stenosis, right? Smoking is the biggest risk factor for many other things. It's the biggest risk factor for pancreatic cancer, biggest risk factor for bladder cancer, biggest risk factor for renal cell carcinoma, right? It's the biggest risk factor for so many things, right? So if you see smoking cessation as an answer, they love to do these with like family medicine, MBME questions or internal medicine MBME questions or emergency medicine MBME questions. If you see stuff like that, you always want to... You always want to go with smoking, right? As the thing that they should quit, right? In fact, smoking can just cause so many problems, right? So it's just one of those things you want to avoid in your patients, right? And then what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that, oh, this patient comes to the emergency room, has very severe chest pain, and that chest pain is radiating to the jaw or whatever, so you know obviously they have an MI. And then they give you a bunch of labs and you notice that, wow, this person's a bunch of vitals, right? You see this person's blood pressure is low, right? You're like, oh, 60 over 50 or something like that. And then you also notice that, this person's heart rate is like 30, right? What kind of MI can be associated with bradycardia on an MBM exam? Or like an AV block, right? If you see MIs of that nature, you want to think about an RCA infarct, right? So a right coronary artery infarct. Remember, that's associated with elevation, ST elevations in 2, 3, and AVF, right? So you may be like, okay, Divine, why does an RCA infarct cause bradycardia? Well, the reason it causes bradycardia is, if you remember, your SA nodal artery, right? The artery that literally supplies your pacemaker, right? Is a branch, is a derivative of the right coronary artery. Right? So when people have a right coronary artery infarction, one of the mechanisms behind them going into cardiogenic shock is that they have a profound bradycardia, right? Because if you infarct the SA node, well, yes, some other pacemaker in your heart will take over, right? Because, you know, they have the property of automaticity. But those things that take over have a lower intrinsic firing rate compared to your SA node. Right. I mean, if, for example, is the ventricle that takes over as the pacemaker of the heart, the ventricle is beta at an intrinsic rate of, I think, about 30 beats per minute. Right. You're not going to be getting much of a cardiac output from that, because remember, cardiac output is the product of your heart rate and your stroke volume. Right. So if your heart rate is that down, don't matter what your stroke volume is, you're going to be in big trouble, right? Person's not going to have much of any cardiac output, right? So that can cause bradycardia. But remember, there are many other things that can cause AV block, right? I mean, like, there are certain drugs that can cause AV block, right? So say, for example, if a person is taking a beta blocker, right? Or a person is taking like a non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker, like verapamil or diltiazem, right? Those things can absolutely cause bradycardia. Even digoxin, right? Many people, digoxin is a positive inotrope. But the thing is, digoxin is also like a muscarinic receptor agonist, right? So it actually has the ability to slow a person's heart rate down, right? That's why digoxin is something you want to think twice about using in a person that has an AV block, right? And that also explains why digoxin could be used in treating AFib, right? Because again, it literally, by being a muscarinic receptor agonist, slows conduction down the AV node, right? So again, many, many things that can cause bradycardia on NBM exams. Also, bradycardia is associated with a person being hypothyroid, right? Bradycardia is a relatively specific finding on NBMEs, or even if they're not all the way bradycardic, but your heart rate will be like pretty low. It's not going to be like 90 something if they have hypothyroidism, right? Because remember, you may be like, okay, Divine, why might that be the case? Well, remember that when a person has high levels of thyroid hormone, right? So let's look at maybe the opposite case. Sometimes some things in life, the best way to understand them is just to look at the opposite. When you look at the opposite, you're probably like going to be pretty good in terms of understanding like what goes on with your other circumstance, right? So if, for example, a person has, remember thyroid hormone, right? One of its jobs is that it increases the placement, right? Remember, it's a steroid hormone. So it works through the, you know, like these response elements on DNA, right? So you basically put more, beta 1 receptors. Thyroid hormone, one of the things it does is it puts more beta 1 receptors on the person's cardiac myocytes, right? So if you put more beta 1 receptors, you'll be more responsive to catecholamines like norepinephrine, for example, right? And epinephrine. So your heart rate and your cardiac output and your contractility will go up. So if you think about it, if you have like less thyroid hormone, right, it will then make sense that you should probably have less beta 1 receptors on the surfaces of your cardiac myocytes. And if that happens, then you're going to be less responsive to catecholamine, right? And if that happens, you're going to be bradycardic, right? So that's why people that are hypothyroid tend to be bradycardic, right? Again, if you want to become a thyroid expert, and again, like, let's just say, like, you really shouldn't be taking any USMLE exam if you're not a thyroid expert, right? You're going to land in a lot of hot water, because guess what? Your friends at the NBME, they love thyroid questions. In fact, they made a whole podcast just for the thyroid. That's episode 251. You really should listen to that if you have a chance. Now, what if they give you a question about a person that, you know, has really bad headaches, prevents them from going to work? They have it like 9 times a month, right? And they have like high blood pressure. What kind of drug should you consider giving those people? I really hope you're telling me that you want to give those people a beta blocker, right? So this person obviously has chronic migraines, right? Remember, when a person has the thing that puts you in the category of, ooh, you have chronic migraines, right? Is if you have 8 or more episodes, right? So if you have 8 episodes a month, that's included, right? So 8 or more episodes every month, right? That's what throws you into chronic migraine territory. For those people, you need to put them on some kind of drug, right? That can be some kind of, you know, migraine prophylaxis, right? So if you see a person, though, the NBME, they love this kill two birds with one stone philosophy, right? So they will give you this question where a person has like multiple comorbidities and they're trying to get you to pick, you know, they'll give you many drug answers that can fix the same problem, right? But then there'll be one drug answer that can fix multiple problems at once, right? Whenever you see stuff like that, always go with that, right? So like, remember that propranolol, right? Beta blockers, they're actually pretty good as migraine prophylaxis. So it actually makes sense if a person has migraines, right? And they have like hypertension, giving a beta blocker is not a terrible idea in those people, right? Giving a beta blocker is not a terrible idea in those people. Now, one thing that your friends at the NBME though could do with beta blockers is they could give you like arrow questions. Again, for those of you taking step 2 again, step 3, don't think that those arrow questions just, you know, magically disappear because you're done with step 1. Again, if anything, and again, you don't even have to believe me, you can look at it, or you can look it up online. The NBME has started bringing a big focus of, you know, they're bringing back some step 1 material, right? So what is one classic thing they can do with beta blockers on exams? They can ask you like, oh, you know, after a person gets a beta blocker, you know, they can give you arrow questions to see if you can figure out what happens to their levels of renin, angiotensin 1, angiotensin 2, stuff like that. Well, beta blockers would bring those things down pretty much, right? Because remember, one of the things that happens, or, I mean, beta blockers, right? Especially like a drug that's like a beta 1 blocker or beta 1 and beta 2 blocker. There are beta 1 receptors at the GG cells, the juxtaglomerular cells of the afferent arteriole, right? So if you smash those, if you block those beta 1 receptors, you're not going to be making much of any renin, right? So your renin is going to go down. If your renin goes down, your angiotensin 1 and 2 will go down, and your aldosterone will go down as a result of that, right? So just something high yield to keep in mind. And with those migraine medications, I guess since I'm kind of talking about it now, please do not forget, topiramate is another drug that you can use as migraine prophylaxis. But that topiramate, remember that it's associated with nephrolithiasis. So they can give you a question about a patient who was recently started on some medication for migraine prophylaxis, and then they present with like hematuria, flank pain going down to the groin, right? Or in a woman, it'll be flank pain going down to the labia, right? If you see stuff like that, you know, think about nephrolithiasis with a topiramate. Right? Think about nephrolithiasis with topiramate. And also remember, for migraine prophylaxis, you can also use a tricyclic antidepressant, right? So if, for example, a person has migraines and they have like a history of like neuropathic pain, right? Or they have a history of depression, right? Giving those people a tricyclic antidepressant may not be the worst thing in the world. Although you also want to make sure that you're thinking about those tricyclic side effects, right? Remember, those things have anti-HAM side effects, right? So they have anti-H1 effects. So they can cause sedation. They have anti-alpha-1 effects as well, right? So if they block alpha-1 receptors, they can cause orthostatic hypotension, right? Because by blocking alpha-1 receptors, you cut down on the person's systemic vascular resistance. And that can obviously cause problems, right? With blood pressure. And then they also have anti-muscarinic effects, right? So if, for example, a person people can get delirious from those, they can get an anticholinergic toxidrome, and they're also cardiotoxic, right? Because remember, these TCAs, they have the ability to block sodium channels, right? So in fact, that's one of the reasons why to rescue a person from TCA toxicity, giving them a sodium channel blocker is not the worst idea in the world. Giving them sodium bicarbonate is not the worst idea in the world, right? Because by giving a high amount of exogenous sodium, you can basically like overcome that blockade that's already happening through those sodium channels, right? So remember, typically when a person has TCA cardiotoxicity, you'll have like a white QRS on an EKG. For those people, the thing you really should be doing is going ahead and giving them sodium bicarb. Now, what if a person has a hypertension and they have BPH, right? Obviously, you want to give them an alpha-1 blocker, right? Something like prazosin or something of that sort, right? Don't pick the answer that says tamsulosin. Tamsulosin is an alpha-1 blocker, but it only works in the bladder, right? It blocks those alpha-1 AD, you know, AD like Anthony Davis, right? Alpha-1 AD receptors are in the bladder, right? So if you really want to help their blood pressure, you need to give them like a legit blocks every kind of alpha-1 receptor, right? Again, something like prazosin, doxazosin, terazosin, right? Stuff like that. Because again, the alpha-1 blocker, by doing that, you open up that internal urinary sphincter in the bladder, so their urine will flow better. But you also block those alpha-1 receptors, right? That will cause a decrease in systemic vascular resistance and lower their blood pressure. Although one thing your friends at the MD may love to do is they can then ask, they can tell you that, oh, this person just started an alpha-1 blocker, and then they start having palpitations. If you see that, you want to think about a reflex tachycardia, right? Because if you really think about it, right, like when you give an alpha-1 blocker, you crush the person's systemic vascular resistance. When you crush their systemic vascular resistance, right, that's going to cause their baroreceptors, right? Carotid sinus, aortic arch. They'll be like, whoa, okay, blood pressure low, blood pressure low. So they will signal, I believe, the nucleus solitarius in the brainstem. And that nucleus solitarius will cause you to release a ton of, cause you to have like a sympathetic discharge, right? To raise your heart rate and your stroke volume. So they have a reflex tachycardia. So the thing is, if you actually want to blunt the reflex tachycardia associated with taking some kind of vasodilator, so they can even make this question with not just an alpha-1 blocker. They can do it with like a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker, like amlodipine, felodipine, or even a drug like hydralazine, for example, right, which is an arteriolar vasodilator, right? So if you see that, you can actually give a beta blocker together, right? Because the beta blocker will blunt that sympathetic response so that they don't have that reflex tachycardia, okay? Now, and I'm going to be wrapping up here soon. So what if a person has like diabetes and hypertension? This is easy, right? You want to give them an ACE inhibitor, an ARB, right? Remember, ACE inhibitors and ARBs, they are renal protective, right? So if you have a disease that predisposes you to having like renal problems, right? and you have hypertension, then you really should be on some kind of ACE inhibitor, ARB. Or if you even see a person that has hypertension and they're beginning to, you know, have like a rise in their creatinine, let's say their creatinine is like 1.5, for those people, right? Or even again, a diabetic, you really want to put those people on some kind of ACE inhibitor. Or if you see a person that has hypertension and they have a history of, again, like autosomal dominant polycystic kidney disease, right? Again, those people, they form cysts in their kidneys, right? For those people, you want to put them on an ACE inhibitor. An ACE inhibitor is the drug of choice for hypertension in that patient population, right? If a person has hypertension and they have a history of like some kind of nephrotic or nephritic syndrome, again, an ACE inhibitor is the drug of choice. I hope you're getting the point, right? Like, the thing is, these UXMLE exams are not just about memorizing. The key detail here is, if you have something that torches kidneys and you have high blood pressure, doesn't matter what the thing torching your kidneys is, go ahead and give that person an ACE inhibitor and ARB. You know, the big exception to that rule will be like, if those people have like hereditary angioedema, you wouldn't want to do an ACE inhibitor, that'd be a bad idea. Or if you have like bilateral renal artery stenosis, you also don't want to give an ACE inhibitor, right? That'd be a bad idea as well. And then if a person has a history of nephrolithiasis and hypertension, right? Remember, you want to give a thiazide, right? You want to give a thiazide. Remember, thiazides, they are they raise a person's blood calcium, but they actually crush the amount of calcium in a person's urine, right? So they actually are very good for a person who's had like nephrolithiasis. And then gout and hypertension, right? Like, you want to give like a drug like losartan. Losartan is actually a uricosuric drug, so it makes you dump a ton of uric acid in your urine, right? So it's actually good for hypertension in people that have a history of gout. Okay, so I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. As I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams, right? Step 1, Step 2 CK, Step 3, preclinical medical exams, third-year shelf exams. And if you're a medicine resident, actually tutor to the medicine boards or, you know, the medicine in training exam. And then if you need application advising, again, you see we're in a tricky cycle. See all the horror stories that happened, 2 weeks ago, something like that, right? So if you need help in those areas, just shoot me an email. You know, I can give you some more information on pricing and things of that nature. And then I also offer, you know, courses, right? Right now I'm offering the Step 2 CK course and the MBME Test Taking Strategies course. Again, I have another offering in the month of April. I will release some information on that, hopefully maybe sometime this evening or maybe sometime tomorrow. So, thank you for listening. And please subscribe to the website, divineinterventionpodcasts.com. If you subscribe on the website, then whenever I make a new podcast, you'll get an email notification. And again, I also have these podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify. So, you know, feel free to subscribe to those. And you get, when you'll be able to listen to it on an app. Although, remember, those podcast apps, they have like this most recent 150 podcast limit thing, right? Although it's also sort of kind of a WordPress rule that I don't really have much control over, sadly. So in those circumstances, you'd have to go to the website. All the podcasts will always be on the website. And then also for the videos I make, check out my YouTube channel, Divine Intervention, USMLE Podcasts and Videos. And I just want to share a short life lesson today. So what's my short life lesson? My short life lesson is to be content, right? Be content. The thing is, I feel like we live in a world where we always want more, right? We always want the best of the best. We always want more, right? The thing is, if you're not content, then you will never truly be happy. I mean, like, I feel like many people, they attach their happiness in life to how much money they have or how prestigious the residency program they go to is, or if they are using like all the famous resources to study for an exam. The thing is, many times, I mean, like, there's this part of my, my Bible study recently that I read that, you know, godliness with contentment is great gain, right? The thing is, many people, they draw their joy from things that are just change all the time, right? If something changes all the time, why do you want to be drawing your joy from that? Because if that thing changes, then you won't get joy anymore. You'll not have to go for that next big thing, right? I mean, like, for example, with med students, you see this is actually the root cause of a lot of med student stress. You see them, they come into med school, they've done some reading, online or whatever, they're like, you know what, I'm going to, you know, my first 2 years of med school, I'm going to study first aid, make my own flashcards, you know, maybe do like two pages a day, you know, not put myself under any kind of stress. Commit first aid to memory, make sure I understand. If I don't understand something, I'll look it up on Wikipedia, maybe do like a Q-bank, 5 questions a day. But then they start med school, and then they see someone using some famous Anki deck, or they see someone using some video blah, 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 blah resource, right? And then they're like, instead of them to be content, because the original plan was solid, it was smart from the get-go, but no, that's not good enough, right? They want the next big thing. They want the next newfangled item, right? So they go, they get it, and then they find another friend, right? They think, oh, they'll get satisfaction when they start this new thing. But then they find another friend that, oh, is using this resource that is used by the best students at Hopkins and Harvard. And then they pivot to that, right? And then they notice that, wow, 2 years of their mess will pass by, and they've not settled on one thing, right? They always want to keep seeking that best, that best, that best. Let me tell you this, folks. Be content. The grass is not always greener on the other side. Sometimes just stick with what you have. Do it well and be grateful for it, right? Be grateful for it. So, you know, you should go on. I'm not saying that you should not aspire to do better, big things with your life, but only do those things when they make sense, right? There are some things you have now that do the job just fine. They do an amazing job, right? You don't always have to keep seeking for that shiny new blah, 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 right? Because again, that concept of always wanting more, those people never get satisfied, right? They never get satisfied. Right? They never get satisfied. I mean, even though there's a part of the book of Proverbs that says that it's better to have a little with the fear of the Lord than a great fist with a lot of strife, right? Because you see some people just by that more that they want, they've essentially pierced themselves with many sorrows. There's a part of the Bible that says that, many in their quest for more, I think it's in like 2 Timothy chapter 6 or chapter 7, right? Many that in their quest for more, they've just pierced themselves with many sorrows, right? So stop making your life sorrowful, right? Draw your joy and happiness from things that actually count, things that actually matter. I mean, like for me, you know, just from listening to the podcast, even seeing the website, divineinterventionpodcast.com, you can tell that, you know, I'm probably a person of faith, right? I draw a lot of happiness and fulfillment from my faith, right? Not necessarily from, having gone to a prestigious medical school or whatever. No, those things, at the end of the day, those things fade away, right? Those things fade away. Even if you had like the awesomest USMLE scores, right? Those things fade away. I mean, think about it. Let's say you're a resident listening to this. Do you really care much about your USMLE Step 2 CQ or Step 1 scores now that you're like 3-4 years into residency? Probably not, right? Or your MCAT scores that were 99th percentile back in the day. Do you really care? No. You probably don't even remember what those scores were, right? So again, just be content. Be content and draw your excitement, your love, your joy from things that have more permanence. So thank you for listening to this podcast. I will see you next time. God bless you. Thank you.